There is an Hasidic proverb to the effect that the only thing that is whole in the entire world is a broken heart. A revolution is certainly the benchmark of our age. It's been a technological revolution, an industrial revolution, a social revolution, a moral revolution, a theological revolution, an educational revolution. Radical change has touched every dimension of our lives. For a world which has in it 2 billion people is not only different in number but in kind than a world of 1 billion people such as we had just a few decades ago. A world in which the average lifespan has jumped from the mid-30s to the mid-60s is also a radically new world, as is of course a world where a man can sit 2,000 miles from here and make a political and military decision which would cinder us in 30 minutes, we, this building, and this whole town. Now, this old world of ours has always spun around, and there's always been change. But recently, it seems that a capricious genie has infested our world. The rate of spin has increased geometrically. Even the most nimble and flexible of us find it difficult at times to keep our balance. I often think of the story of the mother who went to buy a toy for her child. She saw one which seemed very difficult, but the salesman protested, "That's an educational toy. It's made specifically for the child of today. Any way he puts it together, it won't work." What do some of us say? Stop the world. I want to get off. A Victorian man, the American at the turn of the century, confidently bestrode his empire or his continent. He felt himself in control of his life, of his community, of destiny. He had a very simple ladder of logic. He saw all about him amazing scientific discovery. And he knew that science bred a new technology. This new technology bred new machines. New machines meant more goods, more things. There was greater abundance and greater affluence and presumably greater happiness. And then our world turned about, and our new science did breed new technology, and the new technology did breed Auschwitz and Hiroshima. And suddenly the utopian vision became an Orwellian vision, black and red and bloody. We learned again what our fathers had known long since, that history is anomalous, unpredictable, that life is ambivalent, that there is no linear progress. We learned again that in our world, as in the ancient world, for many the definition of an optimist is that of a man who believes that he will not lead out his natural life. And if we were put off by that definition, we were bemused by the statistic that there is a positive correlation between the degree of technological advance of a nation and its rate of suicide. Now, for some of us, life was simply absurd, and some could glory in that absurdity. We developed a theater, poetry, and art which dwelt on the unpredictable quality of life. Life was purposeless, and there was no sense seeking purpose in it. For those of us who still felt that there was meaning to it all, we tried to find new foundations, a new base. In seeking new directions, we discovered that so much of the conventional wisdom, the truths that we had learned in our cradles, so many of the familiar institutions, the great institutions which our parents and grandparents had sponsored, So much of the past, so much of the good from the past now impeded our progress, our ability to make effective plans. We became a skeptical generation, and rightly so. What was really the operative theology in America 20, 30 years ago? God helps those who help himself. And on what was this theology based? On the rugged individualism of laissez-faire capitalism? On the primacy of conscience in Protestantism? On the burgeoning economy of the wilderness, of the frontier? And for putting aside for a moment all the naive arrogance of this theology, which assumes that we know God's decisions and his ways more than any religion claims as his revelation, leaving that aside, how did it translate into our lives? It translated into an ethic which said, give a man a hand when he's down and out, but don't give him a handout. Charity, yes. Welfare, no. How does it translate in Ohio in 1968? Today, a man in Ohio who is blind or aged or infirm will receive 100% of what the state deems to be the basic level of subsistence which he requires. After all, everyone agrees that his infirmity is not of his own doing. But what of the unemployed? They receive only 8 meals in 10, 80% of the rent that they need, 8 days of heat out of 10, 8 pairs of shoes out of 10. And why? Because the society is indignant that they were not helping themselves. Obviously, a man who wanted to work. Or could he? Or could he? Because this ethic left out entirely environment, conditioning, the abysmal degradation of slum living, the inability to feel responsibility if no one has ever felt responsibility for you, alienation, the carelessness of people with a society which has been careless of your rights, which has rode roughshod over your family, your ancestry, your background, your opportunity, your schooling, and all that goes to make an animal into a man, all that goes to make for civilization. The only thing that is certain and whole in our world is a broken heart. Today, nothing is that certain anymore. Men are not clear if God is alive or God is dead or if he's simply hiding in Argentina. We talk of not ethics or morality, but of a new morality. Men are not sure whether new morality is actually a basic principle, something called situational ethics, or whether it's simply a rationalization to get away with whatever you can get away with. And we were all raised to believe that somehow the church, the religious institution, was, if nothing else, a teacher of virtue. And now the sociologist comes along and he analyzes those who belong to the Protestant churches in America, and he discovers that in every index of prejudice, they are infinitely more prejudiced than the atheist and the freethinker and the unchurched. And so we turn to radical movements and radical doctrines. We turn to our youth, who are castigating convention and conventional wisdom, and we listen to them. And I confess we are as unclear and as uncertain as when we listened to the past. They preach radical social reform, but we see instead is really radical social disorganization. There is a call to the barricades to create a new world. And when we analyze that call, we often find nothing more than peeve and petulance and pot. We go to hear a speaker tell us about the murderous, unfortunate, misbegotten war in Southeast Asia, only to hear the young man tell us that Hanoi is the very, very model of a modern, progressive, democratic state. We know that we require a new lifestyle in politics, And we watched the new politicians come together in Chicago. And we find not the new but the old, an almost medieval mystery play in which the white virgin is overwhelmed and overcome by a black spirit, and in her degradation, she somehow finds her glory. Nothing is clear. Nothing is certain. The only thing that is whole in the entire world is a broken heart. The past is no longer a sufficient guide. The prophets of the future have metallic voices and feet of clay. And so we have two alternatives, you and I. We can either simply accept, as do many of our writers and poets, accept the absurdity of it all, or we can look to see what is the healing, the wholeness of a broken heart. How is it that heartbreak breeds wisdom? A child came hurrying home from school, clutching a crayon drawing which she had done. Mother was busy in the kitchen. Mommy, guess what? What? Mommy, you're not listening. Mother's busy at the sink. Yes, I'm listening. No, Mommy, you're not listening with your eyes. As a rabbi, I deal very often with heartache. And I have found that it is through heartache that men and women often first introduce themselves and to their world. That it's through heartache that they, for the first time, listen with their eyes. When we're young, protected in the home, secure in our innocence, confident in our strength, we grow about ourselves a hard shell of arrogance. There's a film of superiority which begins to close our eyes. We see not the world as it is, but the world as we assume it to be. We see only what we want to see. We somehow believe that we can make the world dance to our tune and the great powers beyond, the fears of God, the fearsome powers of God, these we simply deny or blot out. We need to take our heart and to have it beaten on the anvil of hard experience till it breaks asunder, till the klipa, the shell, is broken, till we can really feel pain and anguish and hurt and loneliness and fear. And then and only then do we really begin to know what this life is all about, what our world is like, who we are, what we can expect of ourselves, of others, and of the future. A boy and a girl were climbing up a mountain path. The little girl complained. She said, "Look at all these stones and these boulders. They're in our way. This isn't a path." The little boy said, "It's the stones on which we climb." It's very often the hard, the ineluctable, the unbreakable, the unshakable, the almost insurmountable obstacles of life which make us climb, because they make us see life as it is. Those who have known death know life. Teach us to number our days, that we may get us a heart of wisdom. And what teaches us to number our days? Only when we are willing to admit that we are not immortal, that we are not gods, that we will not live forever. And what is true of individuals is true of a nation. The Great Depression finally broke America from the arrogant assumption that if each person grasped for what he wanted, somehow the greater good would be achieved. We learned community in the sorrow of depression, of an economy which had gone sour. And I sometimes believe that there may be some good in this senseless war in Vietnam, in the confusion, the violence in our cities, in the fact that our confidence in our economy has now been shaken. Because I have the feeling that for the first time, the average American, not the very young and not the very revolutionary or the very radical, not those who know all the answers, but the majority of us are for the first time taking a good look at our country, at its standards, at its values, and see it for the first time, in its strengths and its weaknesses, for what it really is. For a long time, we've been very proud. We've been arrogant. We were the most powerful of nations. We had the greatest army and the greatest economy. Obviously, we were doing the right things. Obviously, Americanism was the truth. And so we tried to impose it upon the world, and we were confident that all we had to do was to continue along the line that we were walking. And then the world didn't want to listen, and now we're not quite sure ourselves. We're beginning to look carefully, critically. Our heart has been broken. We've learned anguish. We've learned fear. We've learned that the world will not dance at our bidding. We've learned that for all of our power, we can't make things come right. And so we're taking a good look. From that look may come a new philosophy, a new orientation, new wisdom. Now, what has all of this to do with the topic I announced this morning? The educated man. Who is he? I think it's clear to all of us that you can't measure the education of a man by the string of degrees after his name. I've known some awfully stupid PhDs. And I've known some college graduates who I doubt today could pass the fourth or fifth grade. Someone described a college education as a suntan. The minute that you leave, the suntan begins to wear off. A year or two out of school, it's all gone. And I'm convinced that you can't measure a man's education by the footage of books on his shelves. When I was in college, I had an instructor who had read everything that there was to read about the subject and understood nothing about it. We called him a living bibliography. He was a series of disjointed facts, names, dates, places, facts, but there are no paragraphs. There was no logic. There was no point of view. It all didn't tie together. The Talmud calls these people chamor noses sfarim, donkeys laden with books. And we've seen people like that. We know them. Who is an educated man? He's not a degreed man, necessarily. He's not a man who's passed every one of the programmed learnings. You can program learning, facts, but you can't program life. The educated man, who is he? He's the man who has a certain quality of heart, of spirit. One of the tragedies, I believe, of American education, of world education, is that we concentrate so much on the head that we forget the heart. Try to cram in facts and figures and dates and equations. But we forget what Einstein said long since. He said, education is that which remains to a man after all that he learned in school has been forgotten. Education has something to do with life. And all that I've really been saying to you this morning is by way of a commentary on a Talmudic question and answer. The question is, Eizehu Chacham. Who is the educated man? Who is the wise man? And the answer the rabbis gave was, Halomed Mikol Adam. The educated man is the man who can learn from every relationship and from every experience. No talk here of degrees, of volumes of books, of reading the encyclopedia. The educated man is the man who can learn from every relationship and from every experience. And when I first read that quotation, I wondered how this could be a definition of education. Every day, every man has experiences. Every day, every man has relationships. But it's obviously true that there are fools and there are wise men. Why do some learn from their relationships, from people, and why do some not learn? Why do some go through life and they're as innocent and as naive and as stupid when they end life as when they began? And why do some seem to grow and mature almost every day that they live. And I suspect that the answer lies in the quality of a man's heart. Is it encapsulated, covered with a hard shell? Is he so arrogant and so confident that his little body of philosophy, his little clutch of facts, is the truth? Does he judge others or does he listen to others? Is there conversation or is there a monologue? Is he an apostle or is he a disciple? It makes a lot of difference. Of course, there's no wisdom unless you have some information. This is not a plea for stupidity, for dropping out of school. Imein bina in chachma. If there's no skill in life, if there are no facts, you have nothing to work with. You need schooling. Schooling isn't enough. For schooling has almost nothing to do with life. Books are useful only if you can see through books to men. History is useful only if you can see through dates and kings and lists to politics and to life itself. How do you go about this? Well, I suspect that those who are rebelling in our universities are trying to go about it. We may not agree with their shrill voices or all that they're demanding, but certainly their insistence that there be no more ivy towers, that the campus must not be a quiet, elm-treed place typifying rural America, a quietness, a certainty that doesn't exist anymore. But somehow the world, the cold winds, must be allowed to enter even into the classrooms. That part of a student's time must be spent in the city, on the sidewalks, in politics, helping others. Certainly insofar as their protest involves usefulness, a chance to get out into the world and to be bruised by the world, certainly their protest is well taken. Most of us went through school uninterrupted. There was grade school and high school and college and graduate school, and we had all our degrees. But we hadn't the faintest idea what life was all about. And I remember that when I was in college at the end of the Second World War, all of a sudden the veterans returned. And they knew something about life, some of them. And they were better students than we were, though we got better grades. We knew how to study. Our minds were still supple. We could spend the long hours. We were a little bit younger. We didn't mind all the miserable routines which were called education. And they began asking the professors questions. Why should we study this? Why do I have to memorize the list of the Angevin kings? How will I be better for knowing it? Why must I write a term paper on the accents in Chaucerian English? That isn't literature. It's a waste of time. And I can remember some long and angry debates in the classroom between the veterans and the veteran teachers. And I suspect the veterans were righter than the teachers. It's a good thing to be able to balance education with that which is really education, with experience with people. Because when we went through school, we assumed that there were simple answers. It all was so neat in history when you have hindsight. But when you have to get out and huff, or in the central areas of the city, and you have to confront a presidential election which may face the nation with choices of men that no one really wants. When you have to try and organize political activity, when you have to try and organize the reconstruction of a community or a new curriculum for a school, when you have to take one child and try and teach that child to read, you realize that human nature is obdurate and difficult, that history will not simply conform to your sculpturing. It won't make itself over simply because you wish it to. But out there's a great deal of hard work. And that when you leave this life, there'll still be a great deal of hard work for you, your children, and your children's children. Eizehu Chacham, who is the wise man? Halomed Mikol Adam. The educated man is the man who can learn from every relationship and every experience. And what permits us to learn? Humility. What permits us to learn? A sense of humbleness before God and man. It is for that sense of humility, a cracking of the hard shell of arrogance which surrounds so many of us, that I would plead this morning. Amen.